On a previous episode of this podcast, I said that writing your own Kafka library from scratch would be insane. Well, today I talked to a guy who is doing just that. It's Tommy Brunn, and he's one of the lead developers of Kafka.js. That's a JavaScript Kafka library that is built from the ground up, not based on libRD Kafka or anything like that. We talk about special issues related to JavaScript and just what it's like to build a Kafka library in this way. It's all on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Hello and welcome to another episode of Streaming Audio. I am, as per the usual, your host, Tim Berglund, joining you in this relatively new video podcasting format. New to us anyway. I know everybody else has been doing this like forever, but we are happy to get cameras and YouTube and all those things involved. Joined in the virtual studio today by Tommy Brunn. Now, Tommy is a lead engineer at a company called Klarna. And he is building what he describes as a runtime platform for developers. What's interesting, there's going to be some Kafka involved, of course. And what's super interesting about this is that he's building it in JavaScript and in Node.js. Tommy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
You got it.
Actually, what's more interesting than all of that is the fact that Kafka is not involved at all in what I do at work. But in addition to all the stuff that you talked about, I'm of course also one of the developers of Kafka.js, which is the
yes.
Node.js Kafka client, or
you know what?
One of them at least.
I'd put that together wrong. I thought that you used that at work, but that's not true. You're just one of the guys who's doing this.
You'd think so, right?
Yeah,
very few people write Kafka clients for fun. But you're half right. You're half right, though. I used to work with Kafka.js in a professional capacity using it at work. But I recently sort of pivoted off and did something completely different as you say, I'm building a container runtime platform. So a way for developers to run their services without having to be experts at the cloud and all that stuff.
Nice. Which is something that a lot of people will appreciate. We don't talk about JavaScript a lot on this show. I want to be careful with the value judgments, but one might say we don't talk about JavaScript enough on this show. As I understand the statistics of client library usage, obviously Java is, I think, only a slim majority, if I'm remembering the numbers correctly. It's not the overwhelming majority you'd think it would be, since it's the overwhelming majority of the conversation. But there's also a fair amount of .NET work and some Python, a little bit of Go. But there's a lot of JS too. So
yeah, if you sum up all the libRD Kafka users, then that's probably a big chunk of them. But yeah, for in the Node.js world, we were historically kind of underserved, or maybe there wasn't that big of an audience for it. There is no sort of official Kafka client for Node.js. But there are a couple of community ones, and there is a set of bindings to the libRD Kafka. But
tell us real quick before you go on, if a listener doesn't know what libRD Kafka, this is like Kafka, but with political freedom.
Exactly. This is another Kafka library that is also built by Swede. That's our main export here in Sweden.
Husqvarna, Volvo, those are actually small businesses.
But, side businesses, you could say, like just hobbies. The real thing is in Kafka clients. Yeah, so libRD Kafka is a C client that is awesome, and it's used by tons of other languages that link to it. So if you're using Kafka in Python or in Go or most languages, then probably you are using libRD Kafka.
Yes.
Or at least something on top of libRD Kafka.
And it's, in case anybody here is new, that's libRD Kafka. When you say it quickly, it sounds like the English word liberty. It is not that.
Yes.
It's libRD Kafka. And that is written by a Swede named Magnus Edenhill, who's a super great guy.
Indeed. Yes. But yeah, so for Node.js, there were bindings written by someone who used to work at Blizzard, but they were kind of abandoned in 2018 or so, and haven't really kept up with the times. And so if we rewind the clock a little bit back to 2017, when Kafka.js was born, it was born because there weren't really any great options for node developers. So at Klarna, we have tons and tons of microservices that communicate, at least to some degree over Kafka. And many of those are Java services, and they use the official Java clients, of course. But then there's also a huge chunk of Node.js services. So we were kind of faced with, okay, are we going to use these poorly maintained community clients, these bindings that, you know, they link to a great library, but there's a lot of pain in using native clients in, native add-ons in Node.js? Or should we do what I think you described in your conversation with Magnus as something completely insane and write our own client?
Yes.
So, of course, we chose the third option. Okay. Or rather, I didn't actually make that choice. It was my friend and former colleague, Tulio, who started the project back in 2017.
At least he's not colleague and former friend.
Well, he might be if he doesn't review my pull requests quicker. But yeah, so he sort of took it upon himself in the summer of 2017 to start seeing, you know, how hard can it be to write a Kafka client? It's just a client after all.
But now in 2017, the Blizzard, so-called Blizzard library, was sort of the de facto standard.
More or less, yeah. It was either that or a library called Kafka Node or Node Kafka. I never remember which.
Yeah. And both of those are libRDKafka based, right?
No. So Kafka Node is a JavaScript client. I think that they have some sort of switch where they can either use libRDKafka or their own thing, but I'm really not sure.
Okay.
So, but actually back then we couldn't use either, even if we wanted to, because we used SSL authentication at Klarna. And that was new at the time and it was not supported. At least maybe libRDKafka supported it, but the bindings didn't.
Sure.
Kafka Node didn't support it. So
and that's kind of the struggle with any non-JVM Kafka interfaces. You'll get features like that and it might take a year. I mean, the idempotent producer just recently made it into libRDKafka and full EOS support, I think just in the last 6 months. I don't keep up on the data there much, but that happens.
Yes.
So anyway,
that was kind of the linchpin for why we would do this. But of course, the first step was to try to add that to the existing client. But for the bindings, none of us are really C++ developers, or C developers for that matter. So, doing that, not super, super attractive. And the other alternative was trying to contribute it to Kafka Node. But at the time, Kafka Node was not in a great shape. It didn't look like something that we wanted to heavily invest into and really sort of bet the farm on. Because we're talking about hundreds of services at Klarna here. We sort of decided that the least risky thing is to do the insane thing.
Do the insane thing. Yeah. Okay.
Well, and here we are 3 years later.
The wire protocol is public, so we can do this.
Exactly. I think it worked out pretty well. We now have, at Klarna, I don't know how many services we have using it, but I would bet it's probably close to 100 or...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, something like that.
Nice.
And then outside of Klarna, who knows? But it's 200,000 downloads a week or something like that. So it's probably a few.
Okay. That's outstanding.
Yeah.
Wow. No, that's quite a bit of uptake. I knew I was going to learn things today. This is going to be one of those episodes where I'm going to learn a lot, being not a JS guy.
Right.
There will be discoveries here. So I don't know. I mean, walk us through the process of developing it. I'd like to know what was hard, what was easy. What's the crazy 10% of the project that takes up 90% of the time?
So the good thing about sort of trailing behind the Java client is that we have a trail of breadcrumbs to follow. Mm. So a lot of the time our work is basically seeing, we want to, improve rebalances, make them be less impactful. Okay. Let's see what the Java client is doing. Okay. Well, there was this kip that did this and this kip that did this.
Yeah.
That's Kafka improvement proposals, I think.
Proposal, yeah. Even recently, in the last year, there have been some kips that have dealt with rebalances.
Exactly. So basically, we'll just need to look at those and go, okay, this is how it's implemented in Kafka. What do we need to do to adhere to that same principle and idea. And of course, sometimes there are also things that have nothing to do with KIPs, when it's more like, how can we make this more idiomatic for Node.js users? How can we make it more easy to use? Because that's also another problem with using the libRD Kafka bindings, is that the interface doesn't feel like it was written for JavaScript, which obviously is because it wasn't. Right. It was written for C. And then there's an interface that tries to kind of glue it together. But it's never going to be great. No. So that's a lot of the work as well.
Tell us some stories about how it's gone. What's been particularly challenging?
I think the highlight of the last 3 years was actually when our audience may not have used Kafka before, and they might come from a very different background than most people that work with Kafka. We get a lot of people who work in front-end development who, for some reason, are looking at Kafka.
Well, this is the story of Node, right? It draws in people who are kind of born and molded in the front end, and suddenly they're in the back end.
Exactly. So we got this issue on GitHub where someone was asking, you know, hey, why does this crash when I try to run it? And when we look at the stack trace, we can see that this person is trying to use Kafka JS in a browser, so from connecting directly from a web browser to Kafka. And you know, we just initially we were, you know, just laughing and going like, what is this person doing? Why are they trying to connect
first
Kafka from a browser?
Yeah.
And yeah, but you know, then after a while we go, yeah, but why wouldn't it work? I mean, how crazy can it be?
Yeah.
So we decided to just try it. So we did this thing where we took the Kafka JS source code and we piped it into a kind of a compiler called Browserify. And what it does is it tries to find all the modules and stuff that are node specific and swap them out for a browser implementation with the same API. So
something that's available in the browser. Yeah.
Exactly.
It sort of bundles everything together and takes a node module and makes it so you can use it in like React or whatever.
Exactly.
Okay. I know a tiny little bit of JS.
Uh-huh. See, you can be a front-end developer if you try.
There, it's already basically am one because I kind of know what Browserify does.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So that got pretty far, actually. But it did barf eventually.
Okay.
And it barfed when it tried to find a replacement for the net module. So the net module in Node.js is what you use to create sockets. The reason the communication with Kafka from the Kafka client is over TCP sockets.
You may need a socket for that, yes.
You may need a socket. So Browserify basically just threw its hands in the air and said, there is no such thing in a browser. I cannot help you, sir. Sure. This is a Wendy's.
That's probably due to a security model. I mean, that's not an API that's going to exist.
Exactly.
Ever. Yeah.
There is a proposal, but I don't hold out hope for it. But anyway, so again, we went like, okay, I guess this doesn't work. But then there was a little light bulb that came on, and there is this thing called a WebSocket, and it has the word socket in it.
Does
so if you squint, it looks almost like a socket.
It's a network connection that data moves over.
Exactly. Yeah. So what we did was we made a way to swap out the network layer, so you can provide your own implementation of like the thing we use to create sockets, and then we put up a tiny, tiny little proxy server in between that accepts WebSocket connections on one side. And then outgoing TCP sockets. And so we put that up. We compiled Kafka JS with this special fake net module or WebSockety net module. And it worked. Load it up in a browser, open up the console, see a Kafka consumer start in your Chrome DevTools. Open up another tab in your browser, it joins the consumer group. It's absolutely insane. I mean, we couldn't believe it. We thought it would never work, but it did. Now, why would anyone want to do this?
I was going
to
say, is that just a science fair project? Because if it is, I would like to spend some time admiring it. But where do you go with that?
Well, the thing is, so we have received a lot of people that have asked about this. And not necessarily in a browser, but maybe from a mobile app, for example. But the sort of model of connecting directly from a server to Kafka, I don't know. I think you can challenge it. I don't know if it's a good idea, but it's interesting to explore and see what does that give us.
Yeah, yeah.
There's also the use case of not necessarily end user applications, but for example, control panels for management of Kafka or Kafka topics. You could perhaps connect directly to Kafka there instead of having to build a custom
proxy
application in between.
Thing, yeah. You know, you need a service that you talk to, and it really is just being a proxy and all that.
Yeah,
okay. And certainly the development tools in the front end are rich enough. I mean, if you've got React in there or whatever, it's an application development platform. You don't need all of that. That's really interesting. And that also, if it's an admin thing, I think the scale is something that's going to freak people out, right? Because the whole idea of the web is that there's this rather significant fan out.
Yeah, you probably don't want to, tweet the link to your Kafka cluster.
That's, right. But an admin tool where there's authentication and it's some tens of users or whatever like that, that's fine.
Could be an option.
Totally fine. Yeah. And it, not that it number of producers and consumers is limited to tens. I'm just saying it's, 100 million might be a bad idea.
Might be a stretch.
I'm just putting that out there.
Yeah.
So, what else, as you're doing this, what about the protocol? I'm wondering if there's anything that you see in there as you're implementing it where you're like, wow, this is brilliant. What a good design decision. And anything, respectfully that you're like, gee, why are you the way that you are,
actually, that's kind of my favorite part to some degree is working on the protocol level. It's such a different thing from what I'm doing normally. It's really fun actually. But then there are definitely some things that I've yet to wrap my head around. Like right now I'm trying to figure out how to implement support for tagged fields, which is a feature that was added in the protocol not too long ago, maybe a year or 2 years ago, something like that.
Sounds
and
right.
It works completely differently from how everything else in the protocol works. It's the intention is to be able to dynamically add fields. I think of them kind of like headers in HTTP,
right,
where it's like you can send sort of anything in a header and it can be there or it doesn't have to be there. That's kind of how I think about it. And it's useful for some cases, but implementing it is going to be different from the entire rest of the protocol, but it's pretty fun. And it's one of those neat development tasks where the objective is totally clear. Like most of the time in software development, we're figuring it out as we go. We try something and we change it. The product doesn't work and you change what you're going to do. Protocol development, it's straightforward. You have a spec
and
you have a buffer. On the other end comes, an interpreted thing or the other way around.
You are so right. I started my career in that kind of work, firmware and data communications and things like that, this kind of had to dawn on me when I moved over to business software and the web years later, that in just business software application development, you're building something to facilitate some kind of work that people do. Okay, so here's your machine that you're building, and the process that underlies that machine is a mental one. It's people figuring stuff out and thinking and learning and whatever it is they do. And, business is a cooperative mental phenomenon. People decide and act and communicate. And, we do that in all kinds of fuzzy ways where there are strange exceptions that are implicit and you don't even realize, when it's like that, you got to do it this way. And that's why code is hard, right? That kind of software is hard. And you can't make it beautiful and you can't make a perfect machine because you have to have hard-coded special cases that you hate and all that kind of stuff. So
exactly.
That's kind of the frustration of business software and frankly why it's difficult and it takes experts to do it is that you're mapping machine to mind, to put it philosophically.
Yeah, that's what's so enticing about this. Yeah,
it is. Yeah, protocols, it's all machine. I mean, there could be weird things. There can be stuff you don't like. There are difficult protocols. I wrote, I won't even say this is dating me because it should be obvious that I'm old enough to remember this, but I wrote EDI code once, which is an old data communications protocol that I never really wrapped my mind around it. It was just so bad. I was like wanting it to be XML and it wouldn't. And you know, so there are protocols that are horrible, but it's always just machine all the way down. And I just appreciate that, you know, you're kind of saying it was refreshing to do that kind of work.
And in a way.
So is.
Yeah. But on the other hand, I mean, working on an open source project that you're kind of the steward of is also very much a human activity and very much a product driven activity. It's not all just bytes and code. A lot of it is managing, or not managing, but, you know, like shepherding the project in the direction you think is good. Uh-huh. And managing contributors and making sure that people feel welcome and that they're
absolutely
all
fundamentally social. And, you know, in bigger projects, dealing with people who don't make people feel welcome, you know, you got those important exceptions. So even if you have this little mechanistic solace of parsing buffers in a way that you know, you'll never it's never ambiguous and no one will ever tell you you're wrong. When you get out to collaborating with other developers, then that becomes the social phenomenon that software development is.
We've been very lucky, though. We have a fantastic community of people that are super helpful and a lot of good contributors. I would say that these days, even most of the big sort of changes that happen to Kafka.js are not written by me or by the other maintainers. They're written by community contributors. Nice. And then our role is more to help them get that into production, make sure that it fits with the rest of the library and make sure that they, you know, get it all the way done.
And there are tests and all that kind of thing. So you're shepherding other people's contributions.
Yeah. Beautiful. I would say that's the majority of the work nowadays.
And that makes sense for this kind of work, for this kind of software, a library. The economics of open source just apply in spades, right? Because anybody who uses it, well, there's a feature they haven't, that you haven't implemented yet, and they want to make the investment, and they do, and you help them get it going. So,
That's why we had transactions and item potency a year before Libardy Kafka.
Oh, what's up, Magnus? Okay,
exactly. I like down the gauntlet.
That's the gauntlet has been thrown, Swede to Swede, by guy with Swedish last name. I like it. I like it. What else is this? You said this doesn't touch your work directly.
There are, of course, so many teams at Klarna that are using this that inevitably some of the time I will be helping them out with stuff. But yeah, my day to day is completely separate from Kafka.js stuff, for better and worse. The good part of it is kind of that I get to switch my mindset, learn something else. But the bad part of it is obviously that it's really hard to make time for making these impactful changes when that's relegated mostly to nights and weekends and vacations.
Right, right. That is the basement hacker kind of.
Exactly. I think that's part of why most of my work nowadays is in shepherding and helping others and providing support, because you can do that in an hour, but you can't write transaction support in, you know, 20 increments of 1 hour.
No,
you need
can't.
To actually sit down and work for, you know, 5 hours.
Yeah, I was going to say maybe 4 increments of 5 hours might do it, but 20 of one, you're not going to get any of that work done.
No.
Especially for transactions, because that's going to be something that requires deep focus.
Yes, exactly. So that's the downside.
So how, if I could phrase this negatively, how far behind the current 2.7 JVM driver are you? Are you like at parity or?
No, we're not. It's really hard to say because it's not a straight line. I would say we are maybe around 2 years behind, if you put it like that. So the features that were sort of new 2 years ago in the Java client, that's probably where we're at. But then there are some parts where we're almost at parity or at parity, and then there's other parts that we haven't even looked at. But I think that at this point, Kafka.js is a good low-level client. And when I say low-level, I don't mean like C, but I mean we provide the base client, but we don't have an equivalent for example, Kafka Streams or...
You anticipated my next
Connect
question.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that there's a huge space there for a lot of work to be done in terms of building stuff on top of Kafka.js. So something similar to Kafka Streams would be awesome. Right now, if you work with Kafka and you want to join two different topics, you can do that, but like it's a lot of manual work. It's not, it doesn't feel good.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it does not feel good. You don't want to be in that business.
No, you do not. And well, a lot of people want that. That's why we need the Kafka Streams or something like it. But the same goes for things like I've been thinking about dead letter queues. So I want that to be sort of automatic. I don't see why everyone should have to reinvent dead letter queues. That should just be message failed to be processed. Put it in a different queue to be reprocessed later.
At least optionally, you could yeah. have the library do that for you. Yeah,
exactly. Or a library on top that does it somehow.
Okay.
And tons of other things like that that I think could be done and would be a lot of fun to do. But they require those 4 hours, those 5 hour increments of four.
They do. Kafka Streams JS would be a significant investment. That's kind of the bummer is that it's not like you build Kafka Streams and there's this shim that binds it to a language runtime. It's just not like that. You rewrite the whole thing and that's big. Now, Connect, it's you mentioned Connect. I feel okay about that because that's just infrastructure and it's got a REST API and a little wrapper for that might be nice, but you wouldn't need much. I mean, people can do REST APIs in JavaScript. That's proven functionality. I think
Streams is definitely the thing that we're missing the most because we do get requests about stuff like that a lot, and it makes total sense.
It really does. And you still have KSQL DB, which is, I think, at the point where again, it in a given application, it might not be architecturally the way you want to solve the problem, but you can deploy a KSQL cluster or run in Confluent Cloud or whatever and do that stream joining and get your joined stream. You know, you can like do your stream processing over there and not have the burden of that locally. But I mean, it's hypocritical of me to say, therefore you don't need one because in the Java world, we're quite pleased to have a Kafka Streams. Thank you very much. For Java-based microservices, you know, people use that thing. So I get that. So this is Tommy's call to action for a team to assemble and write Kafka Streams JS. I know it's been done.
Please do.
In part. No, it hasn't been done. It's been started. There's stuff to build on there.
Yeah. There is a library called Kafka Streams in Node.js, which is a community sort of thing. But I think you really do need some corporate investment or a sponsor of some kind to really continue development on these things. Because when you build something on top of something that is so core to your application as Kafka Streams is, you need that to be supported for the next X years. You don't want to end up with a dead library.
And frankly, it's simply hard enough that it's going to require people get paid. And that's just kind of the economics of open source. At some point, there's a company that has an interest in this thing existing and being free, and they fund developers. And so that would be fun if that happened.
Would be wonderful.
Best way for people to become aware or learn more. Obviously, we're going to link to the GitHub repo. What do people need to know?
They can go to kafka.js.org. That'll take them to the website where they'll find information on getting started or more advanced topics as well. There's also a Slack community, which is linked to from the websites where you can join. We are around 500 or so Kafka JS developers in there. So feel free to join that and ask questions or get support.
Okay, excellent.
That's a friendly gang.
And you also shouldn't feel shy about asking on the Confluent Community Forum, forum.confluent.io, probably not peopled by a large number of JavaScript experts yet, but either of those places, the Confluent Community Forum, it needs to be a friendly place for JavaScript questions. You are welcome, and it's not Java and Python only, so don't feel like it is.
Great.
My guest today has been Tommy Brunn. Tommy, thanks so much for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Thank you for having me.
And there you have it. Hey, you know what you get for listening to the end? Some free Confluent Cloud. Use the promo code 60PDCAST, that's 60PDCAST, to get an additional $60 of free Confluent Cloud usage. Be sure to activate it by December 31st, 2021, and use it within 90 days after activation. Any unused promo value after the expiration date is forfeit. and there are a limited number of codes available, so don't miss out. Anyway, as always, I hope this podcast was useful to you. If you want to discuss it or ask a question, you can always reach out to me on Twitter at TL Berglund. That's TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on a YouTube video or reach out on Community Slack or on the community forum. There are sign-up links for those things in the show notes if you'd like to sign up. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover it, especially if it's a 5-star review. And we think that's a good thing. So thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.